Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
But to go to London with the Yankees, yeah, that's different. a different kind of experience.
It's if you could talk shit, MJ gonna love you. He might hit you with the, like, anybody can win it once.
Oh! Which, of course, begs the question, Hark, how often does it happen that people mistake you for CeCe?
Every single day.
Growing up, I had man boobs, even though I was a skinny guy.
I'd like to change my number. I want to see what else is available. And he just looks at me and goes,
just be fucking happy you're on the team, right?
Yo, yo, everybody. We are back. A brand new episode of R2C2. This is the best of R2C2 Volume 2. I am in Chicago getting ready for the WNBA playoffs. Big game between the Sky and the Mercury. C and the Yankees are in Detroit continuing their chase of the top record in the American League and home field advantage. Really the best record in all of baseball, in case you end up meeting the Dodgers in the World Series. Obviously, you'd want home field advantage there as well. And we get C back on the mound. So we got a lot going on, but, we wanted to make sure we still brought you another Thursday episode. We've been going strong, so we didn't want to get off track. So we've decided to put together a best of R2C2 from the 2019 season. So here are 10 of the funniest, most interesting, most memorable stories and moments from spring training through September that we've had on R2C2. Back in March, when Yankees fans were still getting to know him, Adam Ottavino sat down with me and C. And, you guys know and have gotten to learn this year that Adam is a super interesting, smart dude, very thoughtful, doesn't speak in cliches. And we really enjoyed our time with him. And he told a fantastic story about how he developed his signature pitch and why he doesn't always call it a slider. Take a listen to this.
Adam, how did you develop this filthy slider?
To be honest, I always threw curveballs, like, from a young age. We never really believed in the whole don't throw your breaking ball till you're older thing. My dad's theory on it was, well, if you want to be any good, you better have a good breaking ball. So, and what are you saving your arm for? Like, if you're saving your arm and you don't have a breaking ball, then you're not going to play at the higher level. And, like, what's the point? So we just wanted to go for it from the beginning. So I always had a curveball, and it was really big. And when I was in college, actually a catcher who played at my college, played in the big leagues a little bit, Luke Carlin, showed me how to throw like a cutter. So I worked on the cutter, and I had both in college. And then when I got into pro ball, when I got to double A, my curveball was, like, big, but nobody was swinging at it when it was a ball, and they were hitting it when it was a strike, I think because it had a big hump, like, upward out of my hand. So then I started talking with the hitters on my team that I was close with, like John Jay and Alan Craig in particular, both, like, pretty good big league guys. Mm-hmm. And they were like, yeah, it's just, like, you can see it out of your hand, I think. You need something that comes a little more, like, that we have to respect that it's going to be a strike longer. So I took the idea of how to spin the curveball from the beginning and just kind of took that into that cutter grip and altered it a little. So it was basically, like, a sideways-ish curveball. And it just started working, and then I just started kept going, and so I really think it spurred from the curveball, but with a little bit of advice, it was able to turn into something a little more unique.
That's so fascinating. So do you not even really look at it as a slider then?
I just think of it as like a breaking ball, honestly. Like, mm-hmm. That way I don't have to keep it in one little category. I can throw it with a little more down, a little more left, and be creative with it. That's how I try to think about it.
And most people with breaking balls, you know, like, my slider, I think it's a cutter. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Like, in Paxton, with his slider, he thinks it's a cutter. So you have to think different things to make, you know, to make the pitch.
And it's got to be funny, too, then, when you hear other people, like, identifying your pitch as something. Like, oh, yeah, you're this, like, very knowingly. And it's like well, no, that's it's not really it's what not it really is. Yeah.
And it's never that. And you can never really get into a pitcher's head and what he calls his pitch. You know what I'm saying? Yeah.
There's a lot of gray area in pitches. I mean, you know. Curve, slurve, slider, cutter, like they're all related. It's just like to what extent. So everybody's got their own DNA in the way they spin the ball. And that's why I don't try to get too caught up in the label of it.
Not only is 22-year-old Gleyber Torres having a monster season on the field for the Yankees, he is becoming one of the faces of the franchise. I've been so impressed with this dude. I mean, I've told you guys the story before about how he decided to stop using a translator in his first visit to New York when he was, I think he was just 19 years old. I was doing a panel, and it was with a live audience, which those can be some of the most nerve-wracking circumstances. It was his very first day in New York, and I'm asking him questions, expecting him to use Marlon, the translator, Marlon Abreu, who's a great dude, by the way. And instead, Glaber's like, no, I got this, and starts answering in English. That just kind of showed me about how this guy was not afraid. And we've seen that with Glaber, obviously, early on in his career. Earlier this year, we sat down with him, had an incredible conversation, and Glaber detailed his journey from Venezuela to the Bronx, including finding out the Cubs had traded him to the Yankees by FaceTiming Aroldis Chapman.
You know, Glaber, one of the things I was just thinking about in regard to your career and your rise is, you know, you had to start playing pro ball at such a young age. Like, see, I always think that's so interesting how these guys, you know, leave their country at such a young age and all of a sudden are thrust into a profession. When you're 16 years old and you're leaving Venezuela, I mean, how nervous were you just as a young kid having to learn a new culture, new language, and also acclimating to being a professional?
It's difficult. I mean, I lived my mom and my dad first couple months. I was going to Arizona. And first day to go to the ballpark, I'm impressed. I mean, it's a lot of people. Everything is first time I saw United States. You know, I'm trying to be relaxing, but it's difficult because everybody speak English, and in that moment I don't speak any English, and I feel different.
Yeah.
My first day is quit. Just I meet the manager of the rookie. I remember some players, Latin players for sure, and I got a funny history. I was go to the hotel, and for sure I'm hungry, and wow, I say so I'm hungry. I'm alone in my room. I don't speak any English, so how I try to make a food, you know? Yeah. So I try to call some guys to the team, but the in that time the team playing rookie ball, so I don't have anything. I try to call my agent, and my agent don't answer the phone call. I say, wow. I walk to the subway, so I go to the subway. I say, the guy, hey, you speak English or speak Spanish? He said, yeah, I just speak Spanish, English. I say, wow. So let me, give me that. And I like ketchup. Yeah. And I think they have a ketchup. And I say, hey, give me that red sauce.
The red sauce, yeah.
And he put something. I say, hey, can you put more? And he put like a spicy. So I don't like spicy. When I walk back to the hotel, and just sitting, watch TV, and okay, it's time to eat. When I eat, everything is spicy.
Oh,
I said, wow. And I swear, I don't eat. I'm waiting for the next day. I go to the ballpark and take a breakfast. But I take all that experience. I mean, it's part of the process. And every year, I just try to learn a little bit more Spanish, English, try to be comfortable every day. And I feel really, really good right now because I look back a couple years ago, and I don't speak any English. And now I got a conversation with my teammates, with the people outside the field, and I feel I feel really proud to myself.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, that's a huge accomplishment. Being, I mean, like we always talk about that, Rook. Like, you know, having a chance to leave your country. I mean, I mean, me leaving my house at 17 years old and going to a different place and within the United States was hard. You know what I mean? Yeah. So just, you know, leaving your country and not knowing any of the language has to be incredibly difficult. So that's kudos to you that you're able to, you know, still, you know, you're still learning and still, you know, trying to get it down. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Glaber, do you remember? It's, I mean, it's so true. See, I can't imagine, like, for me, I was nervous going to, like, Loyola in Baltimore by myself for college, you know, for a year. Saying. To the point that I ended up transferring closer to home and going to Fordham. So I can't imagine what it's like being in a different country and having professional expectations. Glaber, when you were going through that process, you're one of the top prospects in Venezuela at the time. What made you sign with the Cubs? What made you know, okay, that's the spot I want to be?
First of all, I feel proud for the opportunity. Mm-hmm. I have a lot of tryouts, showcase with all the teams, and Cup is the owner of the team, give me a first opportunity to sign professional. My first year, it was a regular year for the rookie. I was got 17 year. I played rookie ball and I finished in short season. Mm-hmm. So I take that year like relaxed year. I mean, I don't think about prospect in that moment. I was prospect like 20 or something. Mm-hmm. It's not like a big deal for me, you know. Follow that year, my second year in professional. So I play low eight. I start really well. In that moment, some guy like Soler, mm-hmm. Schwalber. He was they was a prospect and they make a big league. So in that moment, one day I remember I'm chugging the ball before the game and some my teammate tell me, "Hey, congrats, you are the number one prospect on the organization."
Wow.
I say, "Why?" Because they tell me Schwalber or Soler go to the big league. So now you are the number one prospect. Next day, I don't speak English, any English. It's my second year. So next day, go to the practice and like a media guy, try to give me an interview. And in that moment, I feel scared. I feel like my first day on the school. I feel like I say I don't speak English. Some coach is from Puerto Rico, uh-huh. Speak English, and they help me. And in that moment, I think about. I learned about how is the life to the prospect or to the future big league, mm-hmm. because it's my first interview in English, and I feel like okay, that is the moment. You know, everybody after that interview start watch me because it's the number one prospect on the Cubs, and I start feel like okay, I think that is my moment. Mm-hmm. Let me play my game. Let me think in my future because. In that couple seconds, I saw everybody watch me. So after that, I start a little bit more focused in my future. I start like, wow, that is my opportunity. Let me play every day my game. Let me enjoy. Let me work hard because I just wanna one opportunity to play in the big league with the Cubs. Mm-hmm. And after that year, everything is changed. I mean, everything is changed for good teams for him.
Good, yeah.
That's an awesome story, Glaber. I mean, and it is, it's incredible, right? How, like, all of a sudden, when you're the number one prospect, all the attention is focused mm-hmm. on you, and the major league fans are, you know, obviously, they want to know how their minor leaguers are doing. When you got traded to the Yankees, I mean, because it must have been, you know, hard, like you're talking about acclimating right away to the new country, and obviously part of the help was the teammates you had in the Cubs minor league system, right? Like, yep. Those guys, I'm sure, helped you along. So then when you get traded, was it hard to leave them and know, oh, I'm going to kind of have to do this all over again at a new organization?
You know what? The first day, my AM, I go straight to the game. Mm-hmm. So I saw the lineup. And I play shortstop that day, so I go to practice, and before like a 5 minutes go to the ballpark to play, the manager told me, "Hey, you don't play today." I say, "Why? Something wrong or something?" I think my personal thing, I go to double A because I'm here, I was here really well in that couple months in high A. So the manager tell me, I can't tell you nothing, so you don't play. I feel like, wow, why I don't play? So
yeah.
After 10 minutes, I walk to the office and I say, hey, tell me what happened, because, you know, yeah. I'm human. I wanna know what happened. He say, hey, maybe you trade. But he don't tell me anything. And I stay like in shop. I say, wow, okay. I call my agent, and my agent tell me, yeah, maybe you go trade. But the same, he don't tell me what team I go. I feel like it's different. I start feel like a little bit
nervous, I'm sure, right?
Nervous. And, you know, I watch the game. After that game, I go home. Anybody tell me something? So I say in myself, like maybe I don't trade today.
Yeah.
It's just rumors, you know? Everything is rumors and nothing happened. In that night, I start look like social media, and everybody put Chapman, his go to Cubs, and Cubs try some prospect, and I say, wow, maybe it's true. some friend, the Chapman from Cuba, he live with me in that level, in the same house, and he go to my room, and he say, you know what, let me call Chapman face to face, and Let me ask if true, if not, it's just rumor. I say, okay, let's do it. He called Chapman first time, and when he called Chapman, he started packing everything. and I say, no
let
way.
Let me start packing.
No way. And Chapman say, hey, I said it. What's up? And he said, he asked Chapman, hey, Chapman, you trade? His Chapman said, yeah, I'm trade. But anybody knows, because he's the news is coming tomorrow morning. Yeah. So, but I know, and in that moment, I'm sitting in my bed, and I feel sad. You know, I say, wow, I leave my friends, I leave all the organization, so I can't sleep that night.
Mm-hmm.
Because too many things in my head. I think a lot of things. So, you know, it's different. It's different feelings. Some feeling really well, and some feeling really bad, because I leave my team, all the organization, watch me growing up.
Mm-hmm.
But the next day is official. The trade is official, and really I feel proud. I feel happy, because I think everybody wanna play with the Yankees. And yeah. in that moment, I start playing with the Yankees. I say, wow. Now it's different feeling. I feel really, really excited. I just want to take the flight and leave to Tampa, because the Yankees called me. The Yankees called me and say, hey, you are starting Tampa Yankees. It's the same level I was playing with the Cubs. And I'm just excited, a big opportunity to me to play with the Yankees and just want to play and do rock and roll.
One of the most beloved, popular, hilarious guys in the Yankees organization is bullpen coach Mike Harkey. He and C have been close friends for years, even during a brief stint where Mike left the Yankees in 2014 to coach in Arizona, then came back in 2016. The Hark episode was one of our favorites, and he spoke about how he and CC first bonded and what it's like being mistaken for C, even in the bullpen during Yankees games.
You know, when you guys came here maybe a year before CC,
yeah,
right?
I was here in 2008.
Yeah, you came in 2008. Did you guys, did you bomb pretty quickly in 2009 when you came, C? I know the breakfasts didn't start till 2016, but when did you guys hit it off?
I think right away in spring training. I remember, I didn't know Hark that well, but, you know, I walked in and I'm sitting in the food room back in the day. Remember they had the couch back in there?
Yeah.
And I had the TV on. It was early in the morning. I had the TV on BET. And he came walking in and was like, yeah, finally somebody.
I said, finally, Black Chapel. We don't have to watch MTV anymore. It's not Sports Center every day. We got Yo MTV Raps coming on a little while.
That is tremendous. Oh, my gosh. Well, and we know that, you know, Mike Harkey's his last year on Players Weekend jersey was "I'm not CeCe" for the nickname, which was phenomenal. Which of course begs the question, Hark: how often does it happen that people mistake you for CeCe?
Every single day.
Oh my gosh!
Every single day. He can be standing next to me, and then he'll walk away. And I'll still be out there throwing right-handed, and people will say, CeCe. And I'm like, amazing. You're not true Yankee fans. You know he's left-handed. In the bullpen, they think he's the bullpen coach. I'm like, you're not a true Yankee fan because you know that CeCe's not down here during the game. In the bullpen.
That's hilarious, man.
You guys won game. You should switch jerseys during the game, and you go out in the bullpen, act like the coach. And you should be on the top step, like, hands over. See if anybody notices,
Nobody will notice. The only person will notice is Michael K. That's about it. Nobody else will pay attention to it.
Oh,
every fan will think it's still CeCe everywhere. He's like, wow, he's everywhere.
That is phenomenal.
On May 1st, our guy, CeCe Sabathia, became just the 17th major league pitcher to record 3,000 career strikeouts. It was an incredible moment for CeCe, his family, the Yankees, and just a really cool moment for anyone who follows baseball because CeCe has become such a living legend of the game, especially in these later years as we've seen him go through and pile up some of these milestones. And the next day, Adam Jones, one of CeCe's best friends in the majors, joined us in Arizona, and CeCe opened up about his big night and what the experience of reaching 3,000 strikeouts was like for him.
It's a special day for us on R2C2 because we are celebrating you being just the 17th pitcher in baseball history, just the third lefty in baseball history to reach 3,000 strikeouts. Congratulations, my brother. That is amazing, dude.
Thank you, man. It went like, when you like say the numbers and how many people have done it, it makes it special. You know what I mean? Like three lefties,
yeah.
17 guys overall, man, it's pretty crazy. You never play baseball or, you know, when you think about being a big leaguer, you know, getting 3,000 strikeouts or, you know, going to the Hall of Fame, you just think about wanting to play good and like be an all-star and play well. And all this extra stuff is just like icing on the cake, man. It's been amazing.
You know, see, I wanted to ask you, when did 3,000 strikeouts first get on your radar? Because I know you've said, and you told us at the end of last year, like, yeah, you know what, I never think about stats, but this one is on my mind a little now. But do you remember the first time you realized, like, oh, this is a crazy milestone that I'm going to reach or I have a good chance to reach?
I think it was the beginning of 18 when it was the winter of 2018, and Harold Reynolds texted me and was like, hey, man, just want to let you know. You know, there's never been a guy, all the guys that have 250 wins and 3,000 strikeouts are in the Hall of Fame. And he sent me my numbers at the time. And I'm like, bro, you kidding me? Like, I'm 36 years old. Like, I'm old. I got broke down knees. Like, I can't be like out there trying to shoot for the Hall of Fame. But I ended up having a good year that year. You know, I had a bunch of strikeouts. And then, you know, it was just right there for me. So, like I said, I never planned for it or I never, you know, went out trying to strike guys out. It's just something that, you know, I've been blessed to be able to do and being able to play for so long, I think, has gotten me to this point.
That's pretty funny. So Harold Reynolds is the one who first put it on your radar.
He did. He put it on my radar. He just shot me a text randomly, like, in the middle of January. So,
that is great. So, see, as you're going through that second inning in Arizona Tuesday night and you get the first strikeout, are you starting to think, like, I mean, because you look sharp, too. Are you starting to think, oh, I'm going for it. I'm going to get this soon.
Well, no, I wasn't thinking about that. I was just like, I feel like you said, I just felt sharp. So I wanted to, like, just make pitches. You know what I mean? Like, I felt good, and I didn't want that to be on my mind. So I was just trying to make pitches and be aggressive. That was the biggest thing. And I felt like in that second inning, that was my opportunity. You know what I mean?
And fittingly, as soon as you get the 3,000 strikeout, your next comment is yelling at the umpire. I mean, it was a perfect moment, man.
Fashion. Like, they're so dumb, right? Like, I get the 3,000 strikeouts, and I'm worried about the umpire.
And you know what? See, this is perfect for us, I think, because obviously, you know, this is a special day for our listeners, too, getting to hear you right after 3,000. And last year, we had so many people who just loved hearing from Adam. And Adam's he's like family to you. So for him to be the guy on our show the day after you get 3,000 just feels kind of right, doesn't it?
Yeah, I wouldn't want to do it with nobody else, bro. It was great.
That's big, bro, man. For everybody.
And see, just like, you know, obviously Adam's he's part of your baseball family. I did want to make sure that, you know, I got to ask you about what it was like for you after you greeted your teammates, seeing your family down on the field. You know, I saw Eddie Fastuk take them down from their seats, you know, obviously, and then you giving them hugs. What was that part of the moment like last night?
Steve? That was cool. That's cool. That was cool. It was fun to be able to have them share that moment with me. It's cool that my kids are old enough to appreciate it. You know what I mean? Like my kids are, you know, my youngest is 8, so he knows what's going on. And so that's fun that I was able to stick around long enough to be able to have them really appreciate what I was able to do in this game. And you know, not just them, my whole family. You know, my Uncle Ed was here. You know, my cousin who passed away, who I keep on my glove, his kids were here. It was a lot of extended family, a lot of family. And it was just a good night, man. It was good to celebrate with everybody that came out. But the first person, obviously, you know who was going to be there, right, for the TV. It wasn't for Dad getting 3,000. It was for more for him to be on TV. Was Carter. He was the first one, yeah. Dog. He got to be in the spotlight, dog. And the shit was all about him. You know what I'm saying? He was so hyped. But he gets that from his mom, man. That's my boy.
I was at Bill last night. Huh? I was at Food Bill.
Oh, man.
Ooh. I had to duck out of there before that Food Bill came.
Nah, I appreciate you,
cover mine, man. He covered a couple people. He get the hell out.
He covered half of it, dog. I appreciate it.
Oh, my gosh, man. So how many people did you guys have at dinner last
night? Oh, man. Maybe 30?
Three full tables.
Three full tables, yeah. 30 or 40, man. Yeah. I had a bunch of my teammates that from Arizona, live in Arizona, Josh Barfield, Ben Francisco, Chris Young. It was a bunch of guys that came out that live here, you know. So it was fun to be able to celebrate with them, too, and see those guys.
And Adam, did you procure the restaurant? Did you have a good spot for C to eat in Arizona, or did you already know the spot, C?
I think it was already set up, predetermined on if, you know, obviously if the game went quick, which it did, we were going to keep the chef there the entire time. And what made me real happy was when they brought out that big seafood tower. I mean, them big old shrimps.
Them big shrimps. Steak 44, man. Ooh. Thank you guys for keeping it open for
us. I missed that butter cake, too.
Steak 44?
Yeah,
and they left it open for us.
The place was incredible.
I missed that butter cake.
Oh. So good.
I had it two nights before, so I was like, okay.
I'm just now thinking I went from the butter cake straight to 3 donuts.
Oh, yeah.
You guys know this from spending time listening to these episodes that over the last few seasons, whenever the Yankees play the Blue Jays, CeCe and I have enjoyed catching up with dynamic young pitcher Marcus Stroman. Now, when we recorded with Stro this year, it was right around the time when the trade rumor started swirling. To his credit, Marcus expressed a great attitude to us about wanting to compete, blocking out the noise, and staying focused. He eventually did get traded to the Mets later in the summer. But Marcus and CeCe both had interesting perspectives on what it's like being on a rebuilding team. C even offered some wisdom about being traded from Cleveland and his honest take about the Yankees trading away players at the deadline in 2016.
Like, I mean, how do you deal with it? Because, like, you guys are going through a rebuilding year, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you may be in the prime of your career, but you have a lot of young talent that could soon be very impactful on the major league level, but they're going to be learning, right? Do you, like, just focus in on you and what you need to do, and does that get you through it? Or like, how do you kind of access little victories, even if you guys aren't going to have the big ones?
No, I don't think you focus on you. Baseball, you need all nine. Like, it's such a team sport, you know what I mean? So, I think it's just more of the battle to keep the team morale good. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? At the end of the day, we all love each other in that clubhouse. We're all brothers, and we're all going to go out there and compete each and every day to our best ability. I think it's just about keeping the mental at a place where it doesn't start to waver, and then losses start to turn into negative energy in the clubhouse, negative energy off, out of the clubhouse. You don't want it to kind of just make your whole life miserable. Mm-hmm. So I think it's just a matter of, like, CeCe finding little checkpoints, little bonuses that you could see, like, oh, this is what we did today, where we can kind of build on that going forward. And all right, we're at least getting better. We're not trending down. We're starting to figure it out and start to trend upward.
You guys kind of had that in 2016, the second half of the year, once like Gary came up and stuff, where it's like, oh, like you feel like, even though the playoffs weren't necessarily an option, it's like, oh, you feel like you're building something.
Yeah, for sure. But even, you know, early in 2016, we realized we weren't going to make the playoffs. And, you know, we started trading everybody. I'm sitting there looking like, I'm not going through no rebuilding. Fuck that. You know what I'm saying? Like, you start to, start to think that maybe you know, maybe it's time for you to go too and go to a place where you can win. You know, Carlos was left and then Andrew had got traded. So I'm kind of sitting there like, fuck, man.
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? Do I want to sit through a rebuilding? And then Gary came up 10 days later, rebuilding was over. You know what I'm saying? Like, it just happened. So us, it happened for us so fast because of the talent that we had. But yeah, I mean, even that fucking 2 weeks, 3 weeks when before he came up, started hitting homers, it was rough. Like, you're really sitting there. I'm having a conversation with Amber. Like, do I, you know, what do we do? Like, do I want to sit here and go through rebuilding? I know I can pitch a little longer. And, but at that point in my career, you don't want to lose.
Yeah. Facts, man.
I mean, and I know C's later on in his career, was later on in his career at that point than you are now, but these are probably similar things that you're going to be dealing with or already are with. Cause I know your name's out there every day, right? As a guy who, hey, Toronto's in a rebuild. Marcus Stroman's an attractive starting pitcher. People are going to want him. How closely do you follow that? How much do you think about that?
I mean, you see it. Even if people say they don't see it, man, you see it.
It's hard not to.
It's hard not to. And if you don't see it, you hear it from somewhere, from some point in your life, somebody. So, yeah, I see it. I'm pretty active. Honestly, it doesn't bother me to that point. I feel like I've always been in trade talks. But I've honestly been doing a good job of just focusing on, like, living in, like, the present moment and every day. Like, a lot of that's out of your control. I've started to realize that. I don't waste energy on things that I can't control. And I love Toronto. I've loved this country. I love this city for a long time. I love being here, not only in the clubhouse, but also away from the fields. Yeah. I love everything I have set up, my friendships, the community, the society, everything about it. So I love being here. So at the end of the day, I'm just kind of doing everything I can here, and then everything else will kind of take care of itself.
Do you guys get it? Like, if you get in a situation where, you know, an organization kind of says, look, this is where we're at, this is where you're at, I think it could help both of us to put you in a, you know, more competitive situation and us to stockpile, right? It could end up being your situation, maybe it doesn't. How much of a back and forth is there between front office and player? Like, hey, can you, if you're going to deal me, could you maybe try and get me to one of these situations?
I think it depends on your relationship with them.
Yeah.
And the relationship that you have with the organization and the city and all that stuff. I mean, when I was going through it in Cleveland, it was the same. It was Mark, you know, Shapiro. So, you know, I'm super close with him. And, you know, I didn't want to know anything. You know, I was trying to stay away from it. And I knew I was getting traded. I mean, I knew I was getting traded. So it's no point in, like, talking about it all the time. You know, just let me know when you trade me and I'll go from there.
And you didn't say, hey, I'd prefer here or here, none of that?
No, that's honestly, that's where I'm at.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. I don't want to know, because then it just becomes something added to your mind.
And then you start thinking about if a city pops up, then you start thinking about playing in that city. You know what I'm saying? Yeah, and then that don't happen and you disappoint. So I didn't care. You know, I knew I was getting traded. I didn't want to talk about it all the time. So, you know, they didn't even, you know, I found out off my phone when we landed on the plane. And
really?
The travel secretary, I got off the plane, the travel secretary was crying.
Aww.
And like, it was crazy. You know what I'm saying? So it was one of those trippy things where, same thing, where I had my friend set up, I had a network set up in Cleveland, and I thought I was never leaving. You know, that was my home. I got drafted by them when I was 17. This is my place, you know? So, it worked out in a good way, just realizing that baseball is baseball. I walked in the Milwaukee clubhouse, felt like I had been there for 10 years. You know what I mean? And it all was good. So, you know, I mean, yeah, I cried. It was tough and everything. But, you know, as soon as I got to Milwaukee, it was turn the page and let's go.
Oh, another player who we always have a blast with on the pod is Luke Voit. Luke came on for the second time this season, and I told a story kind of unexpectedly about having surgery when I was younger for gynecomastia, which these guys ended up terming as breast reduction surgery. It ended up being a hilarious moment and something that's taken on a life of its own in a pretty funny way. So, you know, that's one of the things we do with R2C2 is, you know, we try and create a place of comfort where, you know, you're just comfortable being yourself. You're not trying to hide any truths. You're just very open and honest, and it's a storytelling format. And Luke and C made me feel comfortable enough to tell my story. So here it is.
Were you one of these dudes who was like looking for an excuse to take his shirt off, like in high school and college and whatnot?
No, because I was like 215 skinny. I wasn't like a big yeah.
Yeah, you know what's crazy? Like when they had shirts and skins at school, I'm out. I'm not playing.
Bro, I totally
I'm
get
out, cuz.
I totally
I'm
get
not
it.
Playing shirts and skins, bro.
So I
can hoop, but I just can't take my shirt off.
Did you tell?
I was straight out. Just no, I'm not fucking doing it.
Yeah, okay, good.
Like no,
yeah.
I'm out.
Yeah,
you got to put me on the team with the shirts.
So I swear this is divulging a lot, but this is what we do at R2C2. Growing up, I had man boobs, even though I was a skinny guy. I did. And so
moves.
I did. I really did. And so I had the same thing. When they would say shirts and skins, it terrified the shit out of me. I'd be like, no. So I got my mom to write a note to one of the coaches.
No.
Ryan,
are you serious?
Ryan can't do skins.
Your mom's awesome for that, girl. Because my mom would have been like, fuck that.
Yeah. Stop being a pussy.
I did. See, you didn't know we were going to get into real breast examination here. But this is what we do, man.
That's awesome. The shit you go through in your childhood, bro.
Isn't it crazy? It's hilarious. And the stuff you like worried about.
Do you have like big
about?
Nipples too?
Yeah, man. Yeah. You know, it all like, eventually it turned into, actually, I had a true, I mean, I don't care. It's all out there now. I had like a cosmetic surgery for it when I was 18.
Really?
Yeah, because it was just like, you know, with most young guys, it goes away. Like, a lot of guys kind of have some breast tissue going through puberty and whatever. It's amazing that we're getting into this.
This is
but, like, it goes away during puberty.
So you had a breast reduction.
I did. Essentially, I did. I'll tell you what. It was because it freshened me up.
But so, what did you tell people you were going to surgery for?
Because you know, you're right.
You
that's
can't tell
question.
Nobody you have a breast reduction.
Would you say you had like a heart surgery or something?
No. I ended up telling them that I had a slight tear in a pec.
That's even better right there. Like, so, oh, yeah, I ripped my pec.
Exactly.
In 225.
When I was a freshman in college, so I worked out like crazy in part to try and like build enough muscle that like the chest would look like a normal man's chest, right? So I actually like when I was a freshman in college, I was pretty jacked, and like it was like not that like hard to believe that like I tore a pec, because it was like, oh yeah, well you're working out 2 to 4 hours a day, okay, I can see it happening. So anyway, yeah, that's how it all happened. Now I don't mind taking my shirt off. I'm good, guys. you didn't know you were getting all this
thing. I love it.
I've never heard
now
that.
Now we know.
I've never heard of that. Yeah,
it's now I'm gonna see you on ESPN and be like, that guy.
Yeah. That guy had a breast reduction.
The actual formal surgical name is gynecomastia surgery.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, essentially they removed the breast tissue.
Wow.
I
can't say that.
Unbelievable, like, right? Somewhere like my family's listening, like, Ryan, why did you just tell that? Like, why did you share that? It's okay. I'm comfortable, Mom.
Your dad just
he just put his head down like, Ryan, you're getting too comfortable on R2C2, son.
Now, you guys from listening also know we've developed this partnership with the Major League Baseball Players Association and began a series called The Shift. I think I just added an H in the word series, but that's all right. We'll roll with it. Now, we bring on players, usually from other teams around the league, to talk to them about the game and themselves in an unfiltered way. It's been a great experience. We've had some awesome conversations as a result. And the first episode we recorded turned out to be a little controversial. We spoke with Mookie Betts and David Price of the Boston Red Sox. And when that episode dropped, there were some Yankees fans and members of the R2C crew who weren't happy that CC would record with players from the Red Sox. So, you know, C and I saw some of the reactions from Yankee fans. And I think, you know, one of the things that I always think about in these situations is think about the people you've competed against growing up, right? Even if you didn't play sports in college or in the pros or whatever, you played against your friends growing up. You wanted to beat them worse than anybody. And so this idea that you can't have some sort of friendship and still feel sort of a sports hatred or a sports animosity or this extreme competition when you're on the field, I think that's a misnomer. And we know that. These guys want to beat each other incredibly badly every time they take the field, but they still have genuine friendships. And the podcast ended up being really, I thought, one of the best we've done all year. Mookie and David, like CeCe, are Jordan Brand athletes, which those guys have bonded over the last few years. And the three of them had incredible perspective on what it's like to have real one-on-one moments with the GOAT himself, Michael Jordan. You want an interesting perspective on MJ and what it's like to interact with him? Take a listen to this.
Now, I always love, even the other day, see, at a softball game here, we're talking with Kemba Walker, and he's saying, man, like, I never get used to the fact that, like, you know, I'm texting with MJ. Like, I get a text, and I'm like, you know what? It's Michael Jordan. You know, he's like, he's my owner. And, like, I always feel that way. And I know, see, you talk about that, yeah, too. Like, it's like you never get used to that, no matter what. Do you have, like, and your guys' interactions, I don't know how many interactions you've had, with Michael, but, like, do you get that feeling like, damn, that's Michael Jordan?
I haven't had that interaction, but my hands are sweating right now, so I'm sure that would be my thought, yes.
Yeah, nah, it was like, I mean, I went into a game, a Charlotte game, and, you know, I sat in the suite with him.
Yeah. That's the only thing I remember about that.
Oh, wait, I'm going to Google this right now.
Yeah. But, yeah, it was, yeah, you definitely had to step back and kind of calm yourself down, because it is MJ, and, I mean, you know, you're part of his brand and all that, you know, he's done, you know, and it was just a special moment. And, you know, I text with him every now and then just to, you know, just see what he's going and talk some shit about golf. Yeah, it's definitely fun. And definitely, I think it's just been amazing for me, just because, you know, obviously being able to communicate with him, but just being able to build relationships like this, you know, and you know, get your... It's an elite group of guys. So the guys that are in the Jordan group are all the best of the best in the business. And so you definitely become, you have relationships with them. And, you know, I think that stuff like that is bonds that are off the field. And, you know, in the off season, maybe I hit C up and, hey, I'm coming through, you know, those type of things. And it's just, that's been more than just baseball for me, for sure.
If you could talk shit, MJ gonna love you. Yeah. He's gonna talk shit to you, though.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, he's gonna test you. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. So if you can go back and forth with him, he loves that.
Now, one thing is, you just can't win.
You never can win. You know what I'm saying? But you gotta get a couple jabs, yeah, and he wanna see if you gonna come back.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like, you can't just sit there and let him, like, go at you. Like, you gotta say something back. But it is MJ, because you can't win.
Yeah, you ain't gonna win.
But what is bowling to fall back on?
Yeah, that's true.
You have to be great at something.
Yeah.
He's going to talk shit, and then he always goes back to basketball. So, yeah. And then what are you going to say?
So, wait, what is he doing? Is he, like, is he talking shit about, like, your start? Or, like, what does he bring
sometimes
up?
Sometimes with me, yeah, it'll be my start. But, I mean, it just depends on what we're doing. Like, if we're at Derek's golf event, then it'd be, golf or whatever, or playing cards or pool or whatever. Whatever we plan, he's very competitive at. So.
And then you start going back and forth, and he eventually brings it back to, like, yo, did you see me play basketball? Yeah. Yeah. That is great. Well, I mean, like, that is the ultimate trump card to be able to pull, right? Like, oh, yeah, like, GOAT, bam. Yep. Okay, yeah, game over.
And then he might hit you with the, like, anybody can win it once.
Yeah. Oh, no. Oh, no.
Yeah.
No.
Get your little ass ring out of here.
Oh, man.
When you hit with that line, I mean, just walk out.
It's over.
You know what I'm saying? It's over, man.
That's painful, man. Oh, my God.
Now, this year, CeCe and I had an opportunity to go to London for the first Major League Baseball games ever played on European soil. It was incredible. And, you know, you guys remember, it was actually on R2C2 last year when C said he wanted to come back because he wanted to be able to go to London on that trip. I've been to London before. I love the city. This was an elevation of the experience of that city, because it was just so unique and special. It just felt big being there with the Yankees. We had an unbelievable time. And when we got back to the States, we sat down to discuss all the incredible moments. And even though I was there too, I learned a few things from C about what the experience was like for the players who were a part of this rare and historic trip across the pond.
Well, you have so you have the whole family there in Cleveland, and are any friends coming in and stuff?
Oh
too?
Yeah, you know Joe Moore and Dee will be there.
Okay, good. You know, I sat with them for Dee especially. I sat with them for a little while in London during one of the games.
They were excited. It was Dee's birthday the first night too. So
awesome.
We had a good trip. It was fun.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, you know what? Let's say we'll go back to All Star in a moment. That segues us nicely into London. I got to tell you, man, that felt like a special experience.
That was incredible, man. It was so dope. It was just so surreal, like being in the soccer stadium, you know, the way it was set up, like it was beautiful. Felt bad for the pitchers just because, you know.
What do you think it was?
I just think the breaking balls were moving out for whatever reason.
Something about just, like the aerodynamics of the stadium? Of the
stadium, and they were saying there was no wind in there because, you know, I don't know, whatever, however the stadium is built. But, it was a lot of run score. It was exciting. It was fun to be on the good end of that. Obviously, winning those two games made the trip that much better. But, man, getting a chance to travel with your family to Europe and, you know, be the first team to play in the UK, it was an amazing experience. And you know, London, you know, hats off to them. They did a great job of hosting us, and everything was professional. Everything was first class. I just loved the trip. And I think everybody on our side did.
I had an interesting conversation with Chad Green before we went. And, you know, first of all, he's like the nicest guy in the world.
He is. Green would be good on the podcast.
He would, man. I would love to talk to him. I love talking with him in the clubhouse. And, mm-hmm. and we were just talking about, this was before London. And he was like, yeah, you know, he's like, you could always go to London, right? He's like, but to go to London with the Yankees, that's a different kind of experience, you know? And I was like, that's a great point.
It was cool, too, because I had been in that stadium before for, I think, a Jay-Z concert.
Oh, really?
So to be there and, like, have it be my event, you know what I'm saying? Like, was really, it was dope.
It felt big, man.
It was big.
It was. I mean, even, like, the way they did, first of all, that first game, the national anthem was, those singers were unbelievable, they were. Man.
And that first game, I mean, it took 5 hours, right? And, you know, we thought that the next game, the fans weren't going to show up, and 60,000 fans again. Like, it was right there. It was crazy, man. It was dope.
It was amazing. It felt like a huge event. And you got to be on the field and part of the ceremonial first pitch with Prince Harry and Meghan Markle.
Yeah, that was cool. And even meeting them coming into the clubhouse and, you know, us giving them a gift was cool. And, you know, getting that one-on-one time with them was awesome, and, you know, getting a chance to meet them was cool. They were cool.
Was everyone, like, nervous as they were getting ready to come into
Everybody
the clubhouse?
Everybody was nervous. Oh, man, you should have seen, like, just the way shit was clearing out, and people, like, they'll be in here at 5:08. You know what I'm saying? Like, it was, like, right on time. Like, but it was dope, though. It was cool.
Who was the person who was, like, geeking out the most over meeting them?
I think we all were.
Yeah.
All of us. I think everybody was equally excited to meet both of them and just to have them be excited to be there. I think they were really excited to be there, and you can see how genuine that was.
Yeah.
And that made us excited. You know what I'm saying? Like, they were really, she was really excited about the gift. He was really into meeting us and everything. So it was cool.
And what is the deal with that? Like, because I remember with William and Kate. That's their names, right? The other ones, right?
I think so.
Yeah, I think so, too. It was like you can't touch them or something like that. There were some rules about no touching.
Yeah. I don't know. I see Mookie gave Megan just, a hug.
Me, too. And I saw Megan with her arms around you guys and stuff like that. So
I didn't hear that.
No, like, instructions.
No,
like,
it wasn't none of that.
Don't touch the shoulder of Harry or Megan. Like, I would be like, okay, all right. So no, I was thinking about that when you were going out to the mound.
Don't touch anybody.
Yeah, I was like, yo, be careful. See, you don't want to get excommunicated.
Snipers on the building.
Exactly. Yeah. He's going for his shoulder. Get away. Like, I mean, it is funny though, man. It was really cool. What did you? Oh, how was the Harry Potter tour?
Oh, Harry Potter was dope. We've been to Universal, and Universal does a good job. If anybody listening to this, you've been to Universal, they do a really good job. It's really close.
Yeah.
But it's just, you know, everything there is the real. You know, they had Harry Scar. You know what I'm saying? Like,
the actual scar they put on his head.
Yeah, and the guy took the white gloves out and, like, showed us the scar. Like, it was super, super dope. And it was just the real stuff. So that was cool.
That was really.
It was a far drive though. Everything that was the only thing.
Yeah.
Traffic and shit.
Oh, it takes forever.
Everything takes for everything. I forgot about that.
And the travel. So the trip was unbelievable. I wish we would have had longer because it was.
Yeah.
That city is amazing.
Yeah, I wish we'd have had a couple, like, one more day to tour.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Because it was, and we got.
What would have been cool would have been to go to Paris to go to the World Cup.
I know, man. I know. I wanted to do it too.
That would have been dope.
And you know, I'm really close friends with Megan Rapinoe, so I was like, because she's Sue's girlfriend, yeah. and Sue's one of my close friends, and so at one point. We were all talking about it, and I was going to do that and go to the semifinal or whatever. Yeah, and then I was looking at the rest of the schedule and stuff.
Yeah, you've been exhausted. But,
it was great.
Everything is dope, though.
It is so cool over there. The travel was insane, though. I mean, that could have worn you guys out for the rest of the first half,
yeah, I mean, we had the off day coming back.
Yeah, you think you were all right? You were okay to deal with it?
Yeah, I think we were okay.
Yeah.
I feel like everybody came back in Tuesday feeling pretty good.
Well, that's good, man.
Yeah.
I mean, and you guys have still been able to play well afterwards.
We've played
which
pretty
is
good so far, yeah.
Now, if you were told you could go again, would you be excited to go back and
go
play
back
games?
1,000%.
Yeah. That's great, man. And
as long as I didn't have to pitch. Yeah. I wouldn't have wanted to pitch in those games.
Because your ERA will...
No, just
oh
not
my
the,
gosh.
Just the preparation.
Oh,
and like
yeah.
Everything was different. And
yeah.
We saw creatures of habit. And like everything was so different. I felt bad for Masa.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was just... I wouldn't have wanted to pitch. Like going as I did.
Yeah.
As basically a fan. But on the Yankees, like I would love to do that again.
See, that's... You know what? That is kind of... I was talking about that sort of with Andy Pettit, who was out over there at least for the first few days.
Oh, he wouldn't have wanted to pitch that game.
Exactly.
He would have been freaking out.
Exactly.
He would have been going crazy. He would know. He would have been going crazy. He would... What did he say about it?
He said, I wouldn't... He's like, if I was pitching the second game, I would have never been able to enjoy any aspect of the trip. I would have been just thinking about like how do I get my routine right? How am I gonna, you know?
Yeah, and how you get to the ballpark? Everything is so different. Honestly, when you're pitching in games like that, you have to just get comfortable being uncomfortable.
Yeah,
because you know, and just say that this is one start is different. Everything's different, and just roll with it. You know what I'm saying? Instead of trying to be in on your routine.
Because if you're trying to be perfect,
then if something's going to fuck up.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Now, you know, if we talk to Didi Gregorius, we talk to Aaron Hicks. If we talk to Aaron Hicks, we talk to Didi Gregorius. They're like brothers. They're absolutely hilarious together. And they certainly provided us with another standout moment from this year. The two of the most interesting dudes on the roster, Didi, the Renaissance man that he is, talked about learning to play the piano and shared some great anecdotes about his budding musical career.
In London.
Yeah.
So we walked in. It was after we came off a season party. So we walked in, and there was one of the Sam Brenners who were playing the piano. So I was like, oh, this dude's playing the piano. We just watch. And I was about to go up to the room. I was like, I don't want to do anything. Just go up to the room. This fool goes, hey, man, go get a piano. So he's like, go play. I was like, nah, I don't want to play. He's like, go play. And then she looks at me and like, you play? I was like, not really. Yeah, you know how to play. Yeah, you know
how to play. So did you play there?
Yeah,
in the lobby?
I played in the lobby.
Oh,
it was
man.
Dope, dude.
Yeah.
I remember the little piano dude was like, well, I guess my job's done. I was like, you're good. Go ahead, dude. Do your thing,
just walked away, and the girl was actually like, she's a singer, so she was setting up like the mics and everything, and then I was playing John Legend. And she literally started singing.
Oh, that is awesome, man.
I was playing.
So recently I had one of my friends, shout out to Matthew Conway, who is an outstanding general manager and head sommelier of Marc Forgione, best restaurant in New York City. He was listening, kind of binge watching R2C2, and he was like, man, I had no idea Zach Britton was that interesting, that fun. You guys who listen to Zach know that. When he came on the podcast in August, he had some terrific stories from his days in Baltimore. It was interesting hearing him talk about the 2016 AL wildcard game, his unique perspective on not being used. But the best, without a doubt, funniest story he told was about how he got the jersey number 53. So take a listen in to this absolutely hilarious story about why when you watch Britton come into the games, he has a 5-3 on his back.
Zach, are you able to tell us the story of 53? What do you think? Because I
saw the old clubhouse guy coming down.
Yeah, exactly.
We were walking out.
I won't name him on air. Yeah, but.
Don't name him on air, but just say random clubhouse guy.
Random clubhouse guy. Yeah, it was 2011 was like the first year I got, well, 2010, I got put on the 40-man here in Baltimore. So 2011 is my first spring training. Have a great camp, and we're about, like, I don't know, like a week in, and I think that was the first year was, like, I don't know, something going on. Like, if you change your number during the season, you got to pay for something or whatever because they're selling it in the team store. So,
oh, you have to buy the jerseys.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh.
If you change your number
and they already made them, then you have to buy those jerseys to redo them. Yeah.
Got you. That's part of the reason why, like, LeBron couldn't change his number, like, yeah, with the Lakers or something like that.
Because they're mass producing like that.
Yeah, exactly.
Like that.
Yeah, yeah.
So he's like, hey, you know, it was pretty much the guys that made the team. Like, I really hadn't been told I made the team yet. Like, Showalter hadn't even told me. But we're sitting there, and he's like, if you guys want to change your number, now's the time. You're not changing your season. You got to pay, right? So I'm like, sick, I don't want 53. Like, who wears 53? So I go into his office and I say, hey, I'd like to change my number. I want to see what else is available. And he just looks at me and goes, just be fucking happy you're on the team, right? And that was it. That was it. I turned around and left, and I've been 53%.
What number did you have in mind, though?
Like, I don't even know. Like, I was like 22 in the minors, but that's Jim Palmer's. That's retired. So I was just like, I kind of wanted like 55. My wife's favorite number is 5.
Okay, cool.
Like, I grew up playing like with 12, but you couldn't get that here, or 22, you couldn't get. So I was like, I'm probably going to go, like, I think I talked to, she was my girlfriend at the time, my wife. And I was like, I mean, maybe I'll go, you know, 55, because that's her favorite number. And Nope. I came in there thinking I'm gonna be like, oh, this is awesome. Boom, he just said it, and then 53 ever. Like, ever 10 years later, I'm wearing 53. When I got here, Nevin was wearing 53, and they're like, you want 53? Like, Rob was like, you can do whatever you want. And I was just like, kind of had flashbacks to when I asked for it. I was just like, I'll just take 53 from that.
That is such a great story. Oh, so now it's your number, man. Yeah. Now you probably
yours. Nobody wears it. Right? Nobody's going to take it from you.
No one wants that number. Yeah. I think Derek Lee, because he was on the team at the time, I always remember, I was kind of like, you know, like, what the hell just happened? I went to Derek Lee and I told him the story. He thought it was the funniest thing ever. And he was like, yeah, Brent, just be happy you're on the team, man. And I was just like,
oh my gosh, man. That is incredible.
So he was talking to everybody except for you.
Yeah.
That's how it was when you were young, though.
Yeah, really?
I mean, when you're young, you're not even there. Yeah. You're there, but you're not there.
You're just like, you're going to do it to ask of you. Yeah. And now all these years later, now Zach's got like a number 53 chain and stuff like that.
I don't even know what I would do by changing my number.
A huge, huge thank you to the R2C crew for listening to this special best of episode. We hope you all enjoyed hearing some of our favorite moments from this season so far. We're not done yet. We got a couple of pods to record before the regular season ends. CC and the Yankees have an exciting October playoff run to get ready for. So we are jacked up for what is going to be hopefully a long and incredible month in the Bronx when it comes to October, and a fun finish to the end of this season in C's final year. So we got some fun R2C2 stuff on the way. Thank you guys for listening, and you know the deal. Be sure to subscribe to R2C2 wherever you listen to your podcast. Rate, review, follow R2C2 on Twitter, and stay tuned next Thursday for another brand new episode of R2C2 is Uninterrupted. Peace, guys.